Hey, well, this is AJ Jacobs, correct?
That's me. Hey, Carl.
All right. Hey, well, this is Carl Kozlowski, and I'm interviewing America's number one humorist, AJ Jacobs, for my new show, The Cause Effect. And this is a Causeversation. Now, allow me to introduce AJ to all the readers out to all the listeners out there, readers and listeners of AJ. He's a fantastic writer who is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Year of Living Biblically, My Life is an Experiment, and The Know-It-All. He has been called, quote, inspired and inspiring, unquote, by Vanity Fair, entertaining by the New York Times, hilarious by Time Magazine, and he is the editor-at-large of Esquire Magazine, a contributor to NPR, and has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Entertainment Weekly. He lives in New York City with his wife and kids, who you will soon learn find him annoying at times, although he's a great guy. And you can visit him at ajjacobs.com, ladies and gentlemen. Give it up for AJ Jacobs. Woo! Okay.
Woo, thank you. Thank
yeah.
you for having me.
So the new book, basically it's a continuation of something you've been doing for about 8 or 10 years now, in which you're doing what I think you call it, or in general is known as immersive journalism. And
that's right.
You can explain
exactly.
That. Yeah.
Or method journalism, whatever you want to call it. I take a topic and I dive in and immerse myself in it and turn myself into a human guinea pig. So for my first book, I tried to improve my mind, and I decided to do that. I took a drastic measure. I tried to read the Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z and learn everything that I could. And so that was the first part. And then after that, I decided I'm going to try to improve my spirit. And for that one, I thought, I'm going to get a crash course in religion, because I knew nothing about religion. As I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So that I decided I'm going to dive into the Bible and try to understand it by living it. So that helped improve my spirit. And now, this last one, last part of the trilogy, is that I am trying to improve my body. So this book is about the 2 years I spent testing out all the medical advice in the world to see what works and what doesn't.
Wow. So, basically, this kind of topic, I think you're really hitting the zeitgeist right now, because everybody's always talking about how do I get healthier, how do I lose weight, and basically, I mean, you really, as you say, you explore all sorts of things in the book, but it isn't just a matter of the belly, or as your wife puts it, your little Buddha belly, getting rid of that. So, I mean, what would you say was like a couple of the strangest things that you learned about dieting, though?
Well, as you say, the book was about food and the belly, but also about every part of the body. So I tried to, do exercise, and also I stress and sleep and sex and feet and nose, any part of the body I try to improve. But yeah, in terms of dieting, I found out lots of fascinating stuff, both about quality and quantity. In terms of keeping your quantity down, one of the best tricks I learned was to chew your food, just like your mom said. I ran across this group on the internet who are very passionate about chewing. They call their movement Chewdyism.
Oh,
that's their pun, not mine. And they believe we should be chewing 50 times per mouthful, because that way we get the most nutrients, and more important, we slow down our eating. That's excessive, because you try to do that, you'll be spending an hour and a day and a half eating a sandwich. But they are right in that we don't chew enough. So I am now a reformed member of the Chewdyism. I chew like 15 times.
Wow, okay. So, but then again, there's all sorts of things that you find throughout the book that people are supposed to, normally you hear things like, oh, don't drink too much coffee, or don't do this and that. And then you find out things like, oh, go ahead, drink coffee, and especially before you work out.
That's true. I was so happy to hear about that. Coffee, on the whole, is good for you. Now, there are costs. There are dangers. So you don't want to drink more than one or two cups, because that has effects on your cholesterol and your heart. But one cup is good. It's good for preventing certain types of cancer, bladder cancer, breast cancer. It's also good for preventing Alzheimer's. And as you say, drinking coffee before a workout increases your endurance.
Oh, really? Okay. So what would you say one of the strangest things you learned about eating? Because, I mean, the chewing thing is kind of funny, playing with Judaism, as they put it. But what's the strangest thing you learned is good for you?
That's good for you?
Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, I tried all of the crazy diets. So I tried raw food diet, which I actually thought raw food, I'm going to save time by not having to cook. Quite the opposite. It's actually more time-consuming not to cook. You can't
really
believe how much time you have to put in. You have to do juicing and cleaning the juicer. You got to do this dehydrating business. So that was quite labor-intensive. And then I tried a juice cleanse. I tried the paleo diet, which is like the caveman diet, where they try to eat like cavemen, a lot of meat, vegetables, no grains, no potatoes, no dairy. So I tried them all, and they all do work in the sense that you're more aware of what you're putting in your body, so you put in less. But in the end, the key is that everyone agrees on, people disagree on one thing or the other. Everyone agrees, refined carbs like white bread and white sugar, that is terrible for you. I think it's even worse than fat and salt. Refined carbs are the worst, so stay away from those, and I guarantee you'll feel better.
Hmm. So then what about as far as, like, did you travel a lot for this? I mean, was there any strange places you went to gain greater wisdom? Because I know you spoke with people of different practices, Western and Eastern, so.
Yeah, well, I did travel a little. I mean, I would visit all sorts of experts, and I went to Central Park, which is in my city, but I tried the caveman workout, which is they believe that we should be working out in nature. So me and these self-professed cavemen went out into Central Park and took off their shirts and shoes, and we tossed boulders and climbed trees, and it was hilarious and goofy, but I actually enjoyed it. I went to Philadelphia, which is like the headquarters of smell and taste research.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, with the cheesesteaks and all that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so what did you learn there in your research in Philly?
Well, I learned that actually smell is linked to your mental health.
How so?
Well, people who lose their smell tend to get depressed, and we're not sure what the causality is. Like, mm-hmm. Maybe one causes the other, but they say that it's important to keep your sense of smell sharp and exercise it like you'd exercise any other part of the body. So, you know, it sounds silly, but actually do smell the flowers. That's healthy. And they recommend a game, which I actually do play. It's like a little fun dinner game. You get out your spice rack, and then you try to guess. You smell the spice without looking at it, and you try to guess what it is. So it's sort of like odor jeopardy.
Oh, really? Wow, that's crazy. So, but as far as you were talking about when you're running through the park, you know, then at one point you're even running around with a giant hammer. And so how do people react to that?
Yeah, that was for something called the Roman Legionnaire Workout, which this trainer in New York came up with. You're supposed to split logs. So I had this huge hammer, like an anvil type thing. And people were yelling at me, "Hey, Thor!" They thought that was very funny. I got that like six times.
Oh, yeah.
Was fun. I mean, the thing is, it doesn't matter, really, what exercise you do. As long as you get your heart rate up 60 to 80% of maximum heart rate, you can do whatever you want. You can swim, you can run, you can hula hoop. It doesn't matter.
Okay. So then, did you ever run into any problems with the cops? Did anybody report you for throwing boulders around in the park or loading a giant hammer?
No, I was a little worried. I mean, we didn't cut down trees. These are logs that were already down, but we did some smashing.
Gotcha. So what would you say as far as some of the other quests in the book? For example, you have the thing about the quest to have more sex. So, I mean, you're a married guy, so how did you... was this like a sitcom level kind of thing? Like, oh, honey, nudge, nudge? Or what did you go through for that here?
Yeah, well, yeah, as you mentioned, I'm married and I got three young kids. So there was only so much I could do. It wasn't like you could go from, you couldn't go to every day. There was quotas. I'm not allowed to say how much they are, but I thought it would be good. Sex is very good for you because it relieves stress. It's good for the heart. There's a prostate cancer. Helps prevent prostate cancer in men. There's one study that says it cures hiccups, so it's got all sorts of health benefits. Not all, actually, sex is healthy, of course. There's many kinds that are not.
Yeah, there's plenty of ways to get hurt, as we've heard, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah. I read one statistic that there are 1,000 penis fractures every year, which, I can't even imagine.
Oh, man. Ouch.
So yeah, you got to be careful, but overall, sex is good for you. And so I thought, I better try to improve my sex life. And I took I got all these aphrodisiacs to try to get things going. You know, they tell you asparagus, peanut butter, oysters, chocolate, cucumbers, and I'll tell you. Really, there's no science behind any of that. That's pretty much all myth. The only aphrodisiac, I talked to scientists about that, the only real aphrodisiac is to get your testosterone and dopamine flowing. The only way to do that, aside from testosterone shots, is to do something exciting and completely dangerous. So go to an exotic restaurant, go on some, adventurous vacation, and that is the aphrodisiac.
Okay. Well, then, and conversely, for all the people who, suffer from not enough of that in their lives. You also are dealing with sleep issues. So one way or another, we'll cover the bed here. I mentioned to you, we've known each other sort of. I've been a cyber stalker of yours for quite some time. People that know me know that I suffered from one of the worst cases of sleep apnea. I think the worst that Cedars-Sinai Hospital had ever seen, they told me. And it made me virtually narcoleptic for a decade, and I'm thankfully getting over it now. But you actually also deal with sleep apnea. Or did, at least. And you went through some of the same horrible things I did. So what are some of the tricks that you encountered in having to cure sleep problems?
Yeah, tell me about your sleep apnea. And, man, that is something. I'm glad you're better.
Thanks.
But, yeah, I too, am a snorer. And it got so bad, my wife kicked me out of the room. So I tried all sorts of snoring remedies. The nasal strips. I tried the CPAP mask, which is one that shoots air down your throat.
So much fun.
And that I found very hard to tolerate, as many people do. The goofiest one I tried was playing the didgeridoo, because there is several scientific studies that say that playing the didgeridoo, that long Australian instrument that goes that strengthens your throat muscles and prevents snoring. So I tried that for a while. The ones that work best are elevating the head a little. I do use the Breathe Right strips. Those work for me. With snoring, the doctors tell me it's all personal. You got to try a whole bunch of different things and see what works. I will say I just read about a great new sleep apnea treatment that I am going to try.
Oh, really?
It's called ProVent, and it's these little things that you stick in your nostrils, and they let the air in, but they don't let the air out. Huh. When you breathe out, it shoots back down your throat and opens your throat.
Oh. Huh. Wow, sounds delightful. I mean, anything's better than the Darth Vader mask they make you wear for
sleep. Exactly, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. It's like I breathed heavy when I was a kid too, and so I hated Star Wars when I was a kid because kids would always be like doing the Darth Vader scene when I'd walk by. The whole dun 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 dun.
Oh,
it was horrible,
kids
horrible.
Are bastards. But, I got called Darth Vader, too, by my sister, so I'm with you there.
Okay. So then you also, before I move on to some of your other works, I found another interesting thing is that you have a chapter about the skull, in which you say, the quest not to be killed in an accident. And I just was riding down my bike downtown here with the helmet on to avoid that. So what sorts of things did you have to learn about that, avoiding serious, you know, impairment?
Yeah, well, I got this woman who's like the expert on safety in the United States, and she came to my apartment, and she did an inspection, and it was basically a death trap, you know.
Really? Like, what did you have? I mean,
well, you know, my bathtub is too slippery. I don't have those slip-resistant decals. I don't have grab bars, which is, you know, absolutely mandatory. You should have grab bars so when you get out of the tub or shower, you don't slip. I have heavy things on top shelves. My water's too hot. It just goes on and on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can address some of them. I can't address everyone. And she said, that's fine. You can't do everything. You know, the smoke alarm is one of the most important. So keep those around and do the best you can.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Well, we're glad you're alive, despite your apparently utter domestic cluelessness.
Yeah.
But, yeah, well, so then moving back into more of your general career, how did you decide to get into this kind of thing? I mean, were you kind of an overly curious kid as a child? Were you always getting in trouble for, you know, giving the teacher too hard a time with too many questions or anything like that?
Well, I've always been curious. I've been obsessed with knowledge and trivia forever. So I used to, instead of reading books, I would just read trivia books. And then I became a journalist, which I love because you get to be a generalist. You get to learn about a new topic one day and then learn about another one the next day. So but I also like to experience things. I think that's the best way to learn about something is to do it, on-the-job training. You know,
sure.
If you're going to learn about France, why not try to go to France and eat the croissants? So one of my first big stories in this vein was that I looked exactly like this D-list actor who is largely forgotten now, but his name was Noah Taylor.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He was in a movie called Shine about 10, 15 years ago, and the movie did great. So he was invited to the Academy Awards, and it turned out he did not want to go. He doesn't like the whole publicity. So everyone's like, well, you got to go in his place. You look exactly like him. And I was like, all right, I'll try it. I was working for Entertainment Weekly at the time, so I just went out there. I put on my tuxedo, and it was awesome because I never said I'm Noah Taylor. Everyone just assumed I was. And, you know, I signed autographs. Will Smith told me that he's a big fan of my work. I had people. It gave me an insight of what's it like to be a star, and it's pretty great because people are kissing your ass nonstop. You get no negative feedback, so I can see how celebrities become monsters. I mean, I became a monster, and I was only doing it for like 4 hours.
What was the worst thing you did? What was the worst diva move?
Oh well, it wasn't so much a diva move, but. You know, like I started to think, yes, I am special. So that effect lasted like a couple of weeks. So I'd be back in New York and I'd be online at the drugstore and I'd be like, don't these people know who I am? And then I'd remember, oh yeah, I'm nobody. So it was just a weird sort of mind trick.
Yeah, you're lucky that you didn't have anybody say, hey man, here's a piano. Do the Rock 3 right now, right?
So true.
Yeah. Well, just try to keep the crazy hair. I think that was what defined Noah Taylor, was he had all that crazy hair on him, you know, so.
Exactly.
You
know, I had a horrible haircut at the time. It was sort of a Dutch boy thing going on, and he had these thick glasses, which I also had.
No.
So it was not a good look. I don't know what I was thinking.
Well, it's good that you have a stylist probably working with you now. But,
I got one living in my apartment.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Well, I was asking, what was the most difficult thing that you ever tried to do in this context of journalism? Something that really surprised you as hard?
Probably an article I did for Esquire magazine, which is where I write a lot. It was on a movement called Radical Honesty.
Huh.
And I don't know if you ever heard of it. This is a movement started by a guy in Virginia, a psychologist. And he believes that we should never lie. But then he goes further, and he says that whatever's on our brain should come out of our mouth. There should be no filter. So I thought, that's an interesting idea. Let's try it. So I tried that for a month, was the worst month of my life. I mean, there, it was like, you know, everyone was angry at me. I'm lucky I'm still married. I'm lucky I still have a job. You know, the movement is sort of the real life version of the Jim Carrey movie, Liar Liar. It's like, yeah. It's crazy. But there's also something very liberating about it. There were good parts and bad parts.
Well, so I imagine, of course, there's the obvious ones like your wife going, "Oh, does this make me look fat?" You know, that kind of oops. You know, but what about? Can you remember like what the strangest question or the worst truth you had to tell?
Well, to give you an example, I was in a restaurant with my wife. We were eating with the kids, and she saw some friend of hers from college, and the friend came over and said, "Oh, we should all get together and have a play date." And because I was doing this, I had to say what was on my mind, which was, well, you know, you seem nice, but I'd really rather not. I don't get to see my own real friends, so I don't think so. And, you know, my wife was appalled. They were offended and stormed out of the restaurant. So it was just a disaster. So I would say, yeah, radical honesty. I actually support a little more radical honesty in our lives because there are good parts to it, but going all the way is just insane.
Yeah. Well, so then we'll be getting back to going all the way on things in a few minutes when I talk to you about the biblical book. But I wanted to also ask a couple other things that you discussed in the Guinea Pig Diaries is where you dealt with radical honesty. And that's where that's a collection of hilarious people. You got to get this, get all of them. But a collection of his essays about where he put himself out testing things for like a month at a time. So so the thing that my favorite part of that book was when you actually hired a firm in India to outsource your life. And tell people about that. I thought that was pretty freaking good.
Oh, that was the best month. If radical honesty was the worst month of my life, this was the best month of my life. Because as you say, you know, I read about all these big banks and firms outsourcing to India. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't have a corporation, but it sounds like an interesting idea. So I decided I'm going to outsource my life. So I hired a team of people in Bangalore, India, to do everything for me. So they answered my emails from my boss. They talked on the phone for me. They argued with my wife for me. They read bedtime stories to my kids. And it was wonderful because I just got to sit back and read books and watch movies. It was like a dream come true.
How the hell did you convince your wife to fight with some dude in Bangalore?
Well, it was an email fight, and I got to say, she kind of preferred it because these people were much more polite. And you know, I actually told them to try to be a little snarky because we were having this fight over whether I forgot to take out money from the ATM, and they did not go that route. They instead sent a sorry note with dancing bears on it, and it was. So she loved it.
and then one of the creepier parts of the book, you tried to go online as a woman for a month to see what kind of responses women got. And I remember one guy actually used the line, "I'm not a gynecologist, but I'd be happy to take a look on you."
And it's like, hey, you remember that line? Have you tried that out ever?
No, hell no, I wouldn't try that out. I mean, especially after hearing what happened to you.
That did not work on me. Yeah, that one was an interesting one because that was. My wife and I have a beautiful babysitter. She is super hot. So, and she's single. So my wife and I want to find her a boyfriend. So we said, "Can we set you up?" And she's like, "Oh, okay." So with her permission, I created a Match.com account with her pictures. And she said, "You know that I don't want to answer the letters. You do it all for me. Just set up a few dates, and I'll go on the dates and see how it goes." So basically, I was in charge of being this hot woman for several months, and it was every day I would be getting like 50 emails from guys telling me how hot I was, and it was awesome because I knew, you know, technically these were not for me, but it's hard when you're getting that much positive feedback not to be affected. So, and then it was fascinating because I got to see what it's like to be a woman, and I got to see what what men actually say to women, which is different from what men say to other men.
Huh. So I wonder if any of that body image concern, did you start developing like, oh, I don't know, like when you're so immersed in it, you started thinking like as if you were a woman, like, I better lose weight. Maybe that led to your fitness book. I don't know.
That's a good one. No, I mean, she's so attractive that I don't think I had any body images.
Uh-huh.
I mean, my wife's friends are like, you know, why do you have such a hot babysitter? And my wife is like, you know what? She is so out of my husband's league that I don't have to worry. It's like, and she actually even gave me permission. She's like, give it a shot. See what you can do. So she thinks it's like, you know, saying, yeah, go try to be the quarterback for the Miami Dolphins. You know, that you can always try, but there's no way it's going to happen.
Okay. Well, so what would you say you learned from that experience of doing the guinea pig diaries, that assortment of experiences?
Well, I learned a whole bunch of different things, you know, depending on, there are about 12 chapters.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the radical honesty one, I learned that being more radically honest is good. Being totally radically honest is terrible. I learned there was one called the Rationality Project, where I tried to be as rational as possible. And I learned just how flawed our brains are. We are just filled with these irrational quirks. We think that we're rational, but most of our behavior is not rational at all. It's based on habit. It's based on flawed heuristics. Like, you know, you see a plane crash on TV and you freak out about plane crashes. You see a shark attack and you freak out about that. But, you know, the truth is those things are incredibly statistically rare, but we latch on to them instead of thinking about, you know, oh, I should not have another chimichanga. That's the real danger. But we focus on plane crashes, kidnappings, terrorism, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the book that really, so far, although I think the new one will probably even outpace this one, but the book that really has put you out on the map, I'd say, had to be The Year of Living Biblically. And the interesting thing about that book was, the subhead for people was One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. And it was amazing because You scored with I happen to be Catholic, and but I know a lot of people in other denominations of Christianity, and plenty of friends who are nothing as well. But point being, though, that you came in as a guy who was culturally Jewish, and you said barely even that, and you were either atheist or agnostic at the time when you started all this.
Right. Exactly.
So I mean,
I was surprised and pleasantly surprised, because I was worried about the reception, because, you know,
people just loved it. They loved it.
So, but luckily, as you say, the religious folks, as well as the secular folks, seem to accept it and like it, because I think what I did, I didn't go in with an axe to grind. I didn't go in like Bill Maher did with
religious. Yeah.
I went in to try to understand, what is religion about? Am I missing anything by not having it in my life? You know, what are the elements of religion that can work? So I took it seriously, and they were okay. So as long as you take it seriously, you can still have fun with it and make some jokes.
Well, what do you think, before I get into a lot of that book, because I want to dive into that one pretty far, you know, people make the assumption, and I've seen it at various places I've worked at in the media, that a lot of the press, especially in big cities, they tend to, people make the assumption, oh, they're liberal, or they don't care about God or traditional values and this and that. I mean, so to have somebody, you know, who's worked in some of the biggest places in the country, like Esquire, Entertainment Weekly, be willing to try this, that's pretty remarkable. Or do you think that that's an unfair stereotype? Do you think that there are people that do practice traditional, either the traditional faith, Judeo-Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or whatever, that are pretty devout, and people are getting that wrong, assuming that the press aren't into it? Or do you think that that's an accurate assessment in general? And why do you think that is, if they're not practicing? You know, why is it a profession where people tend to be? Is it the natural aspect of being a skeptic and inquiring things about life?
Right. That's a good question. I think that there are a tremendous number of people in the media who are people of faith. So I don't know if I split it up by media, but I do think that there is a big gap in worldview, you know, between the left and the right, and the faithful and the non-faithful. And so it was like a anthropological trip to try to get in the mindset of people who thought completely differently than I did. And I began to understand that way of thinking, and it made me a much more, I think, tolerant and thoughtful person, and hopefully a better person, because it is important to look in other people's perspectives instead of just dismissing them as crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So we're making it sound like it was like some serious theological tract, and by no means was, I mean, there's just so much funny stuff in there. I mean, this was at one point supposed to even be turned into a movie. Is that still happening, or do you know?
That one is actually now being developed as a TV show.
Oh.
So we'll see what happens.
Oh,
but
fantastic.
Yeah, it was developed as a movie for years and never made the screen.
So letting people know in general, some of the things you did were that you were like growing your beard out for, this was for a whole 365 days, or did you phase it in? I forget. But you grew a crazy beard.
I did that from the start. My plan was to follow all the rules of the Bible. So I made a list of, there are hundreds of them. And, you know, I wanted to follow famous ones like love your neighbor and Ten Commandments. But I also wanted to follow all the really obscure ones like don't shave the corners of your beard. And I didn't know where the corners were.
Yeah.
So I just let the whole thing grow, and I had this huge, crazy topiary by the end.
Did your wife love that, huh?
Yeah. What's that?
So did your wife love that? How did she react to the beard?
She stopped kissing me after about 7 months.
Oh, boy.
So, well,
that helps with all the purity, then.
That's right.
Yeah, controlling your lustful urges. Yeah. So you put on also robes and I mean, you were walking. Did you really walk through the streets of New York wearing robes?
Not all the time, but I.
I mean, even at all.
Sometimes I decided I'm going to get really into character and see what it's like. You know, what is it like to actually walk in the sandals of these people?
Yeah.
And I will say, it did change my clothing. Even when I was not wearing robes, there's a rule in the Bible in Ecclesiastes that says that your garments should always be white. You should always wear white clothes. So I looked like Tom Wolfe all the time, or I looked like, you know, I was going to P. Diddy's white party. I just looked, you know, always wearing the white pants and the white shirt.
Ah, so the Bible doesn't have the Liberty Rule then, huh? The Bible doesn't follow the no whites after Liberty Rule?
Yeah, I think that must have come later. Maybe that was
Miss Manners or something.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
Or the Esquire Book of Style, right?
Ah, exactly.
Of course, you guys Bible. Defying the Bible, big media. Now, some of the crazier things also, how did you handle stoning adulterers? I thought that was pretty funny. Let people know about that one.
I was able to stone one adulterer because it's such a big part, especially of the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament.
Yeah.
You know, it says over and over, you got to stone adulterers, Sabbath breakers. And I was like, all right, I got to at least try.
Yeah.
So I was in Central Park, and I was actually wearing my robes and sandals and all that. And a guy came up to me, and he said, why are you dressed like that? And I explained, I'm trying to live by all the rules of the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers. And he said, well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me? And I said, well, yeah, that would be great. So I took out a handful of stones, because I'd been carrying stones around for weeks, hoping to run into an adulterer. And here, he finally won. So it was a great moment. And I showed him the stones. They were small. They were like more pebble sized than actual like boulders. And he grabbed the stones out of my hand. He was very aggressive. And he threw them at my face.
What?
So I thought, yeah, he was like, he made the first move. So, you know, the Bible also says an eye for an eye. So I thought, all right, I have license to throw one at him. So that is, I tossed one at him, and he didn't like it, and he brushed by me, and we had a tense little standoff. But it was I was able to check it off the list, and I felt much better.
Yeah. And what was it? Was there any rule that you were like, oh, I really don't want to do this?
Hmm. Well, tons of them. I mean, they're incredibly challenging. I mean, they came in two parts. There's the ones that, like, you know, they say no gossiping, no lying, no coveting. As you know, as you mentioned, I'm a journalist, and I live in New York.
So you have to gossip.
That's my life. But then there are also the really hard ones, like the in the Hebrew Scriptures, it talks about you cannot touch women during their time of month. And if you take Leviticus really seriously, it says that if a woman sits on a seat during her time of month, then that seat will become impure, and you cannot sit on it, or else you will become impure. My wife, I told my wife, and she's like, that is so offensive. So she sat in every seat in our apartment while she was menstruating so that I had to stand for the rest of the year.
Wow. Did you do that or no?
Yeah, I did.
Stood the whole rest of the year?
I found some benches that I could sit on. I sat on the floor, but yeah.
Wow.
Other than that, she got me.
Wow, that's crazy. How did your kids react to, how old are they? They must have been, kind of weirded out by some of these changes you were going through.
Yeah, well, I had the one kid at the time. During the year, the first rule in the Bible, very first rule is be fruitful and multiply. So I was like, all right. And that year we did have twins.
Wow.
So I followed that commandment. And the older one, he was most weirded out when I shaved my beard. He was like, one day I had a beard and the next day I don't. And he was like, who the hell is this guy? This is a strange guy in our apartment. So that freaked him out.
I'm surprised the beard did not make him think there's a strange guy in the apartment. It's when you shave it that he gets weirded out.
Yeah, well, the beard came in gradually so you could see what was going on.
Oh.
Then one day it was gone and he was like, what the?
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's crazy, man. So what do you feel that you learned overall about going through that experience? Has it lasted? I mean, has it had an impact on you where you're still, you now do have a belief or that you follow any of this stuff or what?
Yeah, it's had, dozens of impacts. I'll only give you a couple because we don't have all day, but
yeah.
One is that it made me much more grateful and thankful because the Bible says that you have to say prayers of thanksgiving. So I was taking that literally. You have to thank for everything. So, I'd press the elevator button, and I'd be thankful the elevator came. I'd get in the elevator. I'd be thankful that it didn't plummet to the basement. And so you're saying hundreds of thanks a day, and it was weird, but it also made me realize there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we just take for granted. And we focus on the four or five that go wrong. So that was a total change in my perspective. I try to be grateful for the small things that go right. I also ended up, we did end up joining a synagogue. And it's a Reform synagogue, and we don't really go that often. But we are members. I figure it's like a gym membership. Just by being a member, you lose weight.
Yeah.
So just by being a member, we're a little more spiritually elevated. But I do want my kids to have some basis in religion, just at least a taste of it, so because then they can choose whether to accept it in there later or reject it, but at least they'll have some knowledge.
Sure. Well, I guess we're getting close to the end soon, but I wanted to also touch on the first book that got you into this was The Know-It-All, where you actually set about trying to read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica cover to cover, and that was in the space of a year as well. These are usually about a year, right? Or was that less time?
That actually took a little more time.
Really?
Because it turned out to be quite a long book. It was like 44 million words, 33,000 pages. So it took me about a year and 3 or 4 months.
How much were you having to read a day? Was that an 8-hour reading schedule or what to get through?
About 6 hours a day. I didn't have much of a life. I did have a day job. I was working at Esquire at the time. So I really have no idea how that happened. Because I don't think I could do that now, especially with the kids. They'd be like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah. So, but what was, do you recall, I think you've mentioned in some of your publicity for the new book, you say, well, you've forgotten about 98% of what you absorbed, but at the time you were annoying the hell out of people, weren't you, by being a know-it-all?
It's so true, yeah. I was my wife started to find the $1 for every irrelevant fact I've inserted into conversation. So she made quite a killing on the project. I was just so enthusiastic about this knowledge that I couldn't help myself. Now I've gotten much better. But, you know, at the time, if I would see a cat, I would, the Egyptians used to make mummies out of cats. And they also made mummies out of mice, so the cats would have something to eat in the afterlife. So they were very considerate that way. It would just be constantly bubbling up in my mind, and sometimes I just had to share.
All right. So do you know what you got going on next? What's the next plan? I mean, are you right now, I'm sure you're going to be on a big book tour and everything, but is there any other major goal that you already know is the next book?
I don't have a set one yet. I get a lot of suggestions from readers who email me, which I love. One of the more popular ones is that my wife and I should go through all the positions in the Kama Sutra, which my wife immediately put the kibosh on. She's like, no way. And I have to say I'm fine with that because I don't think I have flexibility.
If you have a perfectly toned body, you probably do.
Well, I know, not even with my new healthy body. I don't know if you've seen some of those pictures. But, that one's not going to happen.
Okay.
But I'll definitely come up with something new.
Okay. All right. Well, so where's the tour taking you? Are you getting more response with the new book from TV programs and radio than the other ones? Because I think this is the one that's really universal. I mean, as big as Biblical was, I think this is the one that's going to be taking you 10 times further.
It is, actually. I feel very lucky. Everyone does have a body, and most of us want to stay alive and be healthy. So it does seem to have gotten a good reaction, thank God, knock on wood. And, I've been on several shows. I was just on Nightline, Good Morning America, Dr. Oz. I was very excited this morning. I taped a show on the Weather Channel. I did not see that coming, but I'll do it.
The Weather Channel? How did this topic address itself to the weather?
They got a show called Wake Up with Al, with Al Roker.
Well. There you go.
And we talked about breakfast, what people should be eating for breakfast.
Yeah, 2:30 in the morning. That's what he's on, isn't it? I'm like, what?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, I'm a night owl, right, man. I see it all. You know, so it's like way too early with Willie Geist. Wake up with Al. It's like, yeah, what do you eat for breakfast? I don't know. Go back to bed. And if you're eating at 2:30 in the morning, you're not going to have a good body. Right? But I don't know. Maybe on the East Coast, it's 5:30. So. Still, that's a little early. But, hey, man, just want to say thanks a million for being the first extensive cause conversation on my new show, The Cause Effect. And good luck with everything. And if you're in L.A., everybody check out AJ in person on Wednesday, April 25th at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena. And check him out at his website, ajjacobs.com, to find out where else you can see him around the country. And go buy the new book, which is amazing, called Drop Dead Healthy, and all his other books. So thanks a lot. Appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you, Carl. And I love reading your stuff, too. So I look forward to reading more of your work.
Yeah, AJ gave me a cover plug. You can find my book at my website, americasfunniestreporter.com. Check it out. Seize the day job. And God knows, I wish I had the sales numbers that AJ has, but hey. Thanks a lot, folks. I appreciate it. Thanks, AJ.
Thanks, Carl.
Hey, bye.